The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jim Race. This is episode number 217 for Friday, March 5th. And I've got my loyal cohort, if you will, Martin Darlington back with us again. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, really, really good and absolutely buzzing. The season started. We had a fantastic weekend of races. Okay, we've got another month to wait, but we've got some real racing to talk about.
Yeah, no doubt. And in fact, talk about an opener. And, you know, you and I will get into the nitty-gritty and the nuts and bolts of what the results were in that for a bit. But, man, what a great way to start the season. I was literally overjoyed, if you will.
Yeah, and I reckon Leon, the weekend before every race now, is going to want to be interviewed by us because it's obviously it's a lucky charm for him. What a fantastic weekend for the boy.
That was a bit of a coup, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Talk about a lead-in. I've kind of been smiling all week because I'm like, okay, we got Leon and Ron last week. And the feedback, and thank you for MotoGPOD.audience for being as happy as I was about it, but it was very cool. So let's just start rolling with the show. You know, we got a bunch of listener email, and it was really hard to distill it down and figure out what to talk about. But there was one from actually a couple of weeks ago when you had and I had a conversation, and a brief one, if it was, but about a claiming that was done with the Yoshimura Forks for AMA way back in the day. And yep. I kind of got a, what's the word I'm looking for? Not a disclaimer.
You had a slightly blurry memory of something happening, Matt Maladin, wasn't it?
And we got an email that was essentially a very, very hardcore clarification, and I totally appreciate it, from Joe Camacho, and thank you, Joe, for writing in. And so I'm going to walk through this. I'm going to kind of paraphrase it, if you will.
Sure.
Jim, the racer you refer to is David Dupre. He and I worked together at a shop in Tucson while I was in college. You called him some club racer, and I did, and I feel bad about it, and felt that he deserved a little bit more credit. Dave was a racer to the extreme. Everything in his life revolved around getting on the track. He was very fast and could have probably made money chasing contingency. But he always seemed to gravitate towards the national. He was close to getting a ride with a national team until he crashed in turn 8-9 at Willow Springs. And trust me, that is not a place you want to crash, Martin. Oof.
Sure.
Very high speed. Ripping off his kneecap and having to have it put back on, he never recovered his full mobility. He claimed Maladin's Forks at Loudon, and that much I knew, for $7,500. I was there with him, and he was asked to supervise the Ghost team when they removed the forks, and Dave was dealing with the AMA. Don Secacora repeatedly asked, "Are you guys sure you want to do this?" The mechanics were talking about kicking Dave's ass and how he would be blackballed in the sport, etc. I watched one of the mechanics run a flat blade screwdriver up and down the show's fork leg, gouging it near the seal. They also screwed in the compression adjusters until the thread stripped. Months later, I had to give a deposition to Dave's attorney telling what I saw. They settled out of court. Dave was just going to sell the forks and make some money to keep racing. I lost touch with Dave after graduating and leaving college, but ran into Daytona in 2001 when he was racing a RSVR, Aprilia, and lastly, Mid-Ohio in 2003 on a GSXR 1000. Thanks and keep the great work coming. And thank you, Joe Camacho, for that backgrounder. That's, you know, again, Martin, that's the kind of thing that I really love about doing this show is we get filled in by other people. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. But I also found in that story there's quite a bit of pathos in there because you think this is a guy who's so motivated to keep – and also some really imaginative thinking there. Right, I'll claim his forks. They'll cost me $7,500. But then, I mean, this is obviously pre-eBay days. You know, you imagine now, stick Matt Maladin's forks on eBay – to make some monies to keep him racing. I'm a little bit sad that someone would destroy what was, you know, completely going outside the spirit of the thing. Maybe if he just said to him, look, I don't want them to stop you having them. I want them because I need to make a bit of money to keep racing. They might have seen them in a different light. I don't know. But, you know, brilliant, illuminating email that, though.
Yeah, claiming roles have always been really strange. And you remember when they proposed them for Moto 2 last year, which, and it's a rule that they scrapped.
Yeah.
But it does create a significant amount of tension because, man, you know, these teams, it's a very strange little thing because claiming rules are intended to provide parity, right? So don't overspend on part A because somebody might be able to get it from you for a song, right? But at the same time, if you are somebody that plays off of the claiming rule and does it, you're kind of going to be demonized, and it's true in a way. And so it's why they kind of quite often people just don't do it. Because it, and it's the same thing with doing a protest in a race, all the way down to club level racing. You don't want to be that guy. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. And also, I guess you've got to be careful politically.
Well, yeah.
Who you want to do it to.
Yeah, yeah. Who are you going to piss off?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It essentially creates this thing where it's like, this may be a bridge I've never crossed, but do I want to burn it right now? This show has something really cool and may have a couple, but the one that I've got in the can right now, and you had a chance to listen to it, and I know that you enjoyed it, but we've got a great, great interview with James Witham, who is a Eurosport commentator, but we kind of go back over all of his history in the past, and I know you liked it. You enjoyed it, didn't you?
Absolutely. I mean, Jamie Witham comes across in interviews I've seen him in, the interview we've just listened to, when he's commenting on telly, you know, I mean, we were discussing that just how open he was and how freely he was willing to share his opinions. I don't think he could speak without doing so. You know, he's such a humorous, light-hearted, but at the same time, an incisive commentator. And I was saying to you earlier, if I'm watching WSB and it's not Jack Burnicle and Jamie Whittam, I sort of think, oh, because they add so much. You know, they are very much on a par with Julian Ryder and Toby Moody when they had Mamola as the colour guy and all that. And because he's raced and he knows most of the guys, you know, it's absolutely fantastic interview. At this stage, I'm just going to mention his book as well, What a Good Do, which is written exactly as this interview runs. It's not available on Amazon.com, but for American listeners who might be interested in reading it, it's on Amazon.co.uk for £6 for the paperback, and I'm sure they'll ship to America. It is brilliant.
Okay, and what we'll do is we'll have a link to that, but Martin, let's run this, and then once it's done, we can talk about individual bits, because there's so much enlightening stuff in it, and frankly, it is one of my most favorite interviews that I've ever done. So let's roll it. Roll on. Hello, this is Trim Race for MotoGPOD, and got another great interview on the line for you guys this weekend. I'm speaking with James Witham, who is an announcer for Eurosport, does BSB and World Superbike, and I'm very pleased to have him on. How are you, James?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you got a chance to join us. Really looking forward to having a talk with you. Your career, well, your multiple careers, if you will, to me are extremely interesting. So if it's okay, can I do a quick rundown on your riding career?
Yeah, of course you
can. Okay. And correct anything that I have wrong, because I kind of had to piece this together. 1986, you ran some 125 GP stuff, at least MotoGP.com says that, and you won the British ADCC Championship.
Yes, correct.
Okay. In between everything, because this to me is actually incredibly cool, you did a lot of real roads racing, both at the TT and I'm guessing Ulster and other places. Can you fill me in on that?
Yeah, I did TT, I did the Manx Grand Prix in 85 and then TT 86, 87, 89. Also Ulster, Northwest 200, finished second at the Northwest 100, third at the TT in one of the production classes. But essentially, I was the kind of rider who tried kind of 110% the whole time. And the pure roads were possibly not the place to do that when you're in your early 20s and a little bit daft. And I had, every time I went to the Isle of Man, I pretty much fell off. And I had a couple of real close calls where I was whizzing past gate posts at kind of 150 miles an hour and decided that it wasn't for me at the end of 89.
You know, I did an interview last June, I think, with Sean Harris, who also has had his issues, if you will, at the TT.
Yep.
And, you know, the TT, frankly, to me, is the thing that really got me interested in road racing back in the early 80s. And, you know, my personal hero is Joey Dunlop, and there's probably a lot.
Yeah. One of mine, too.
Yeah. Okay, so 90 through 98, you kind of bounced back and forth between World Superbike and BSP. You had a couple of GP appearances in 1992, but you spent most of your career with Ducati and later with Harris, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. 99, you did 7 GP 500 races on the Modenas KR3, which frankly was kind of a nail, wasn't it?
It was a bike that had not just quite enough power to compete on power, and not just quite the backing behind it, testing-wise, to be... It was a very light bike, and a bike that you really had to ride like a 250, and I didn't have enough time to get to grips with it. We had some kind of sparks of reasonable sort of riding. We got quickest sector times of the whole race in F1s and all that sort of thing, but really I didn't have enough time to A, do it justice, and B, stop myself eyesight into the crowd, really. But I really, really enjoyed it. I wouldn't have missed it for the world, because I got to work with Kenny Roberts, and he is one of my kind of heroes from being a kid.
And I guess that's a secondary question. What was it like working for Kenny Sr.? Because we all kind of know that he is very solidly focused, if you will.
He's mad as a plant pot. He's completely bonkers, but in a brilliant kind of way. And I tell you what, he has this aura about him. And I know who Kenny Roberts is. My wife knows who Kenny Roberts is because we've been into riding and we've been into racing. And you cannot, if you've been into bikes for any length of time, you know who Kenny Roberts is. But I've walked into places with him where there's been people who are not into bikes, and this he still has something about him. He has a kind of aura of he's you know, he's important. Do you know what I mean? But he was a lot of fun and very focused on the racing and making sure that we did what we had to do, and he tried to give us what we needed. But he was unforgiving in that if Kenny Roberts tells you what you're doing wrong, you take it on the chin. And you believe it.
Okay.
You know, when I've had other team managers who's never ridden, you know what it's like. If someone's telling you how to do something and they can't do it, you kind of take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But when Kenny Roberts tells you that you're doing something wrong, you kind of have to go, okay.
You know, it's kind of interesting because Vittorio Gresci has taken over the management of the factory courses squad in MotoGP.
Yeah, and
he was their tester for years, and it, the first Sepang test this year, you've never heard of this. You know, he, as a manager, went out and actually tested 10 unique bikes at Sepang prior to them doing the actual test. And I was just blown away by that. You never see that.
No. I mean, I've actually worked with Vittorio. He's a good kid, and he's a man who should have gone a lot further in racing than what he did.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so moving on, 2002, you had kind of your brilliant swan song in World Supersport, and, you know, you held the Donington Park lap record until I think it was 2007. It must have been kind of the high point in your career.
Yeah, I mean, you look back at a career, and you think, some of the things I remember as being probably at me riding my best, nobody else will remember because I didn't get the result that... You know, some of the best rides I've had weren't wins. They were maybe finishing fifth on a bike that shouldn't have finished in the top 10, if you know what I mean. It's really weird what other people see as, you know, your best ride. Sometimes they're not. But I've got to say, the Supersport years were just they were a breath of fresh air. I did 3 years for an Italian team that now run the World Superbike effort. They were called Belgari Yamaha, now they're called Yamaha Motor Italy, but it's the same team essentially, based at Monza near Milan. And it was what I loved about the Supersport bike was because the rules are a lot tighter than Superbike, or especially MotoGP or GP as it was then. You know, you're tied to standard fork external, standard wheel, standard brakes, standard calipers, and standard geometry on the swing arm, standard chassis, standard head angle. Because of all that, you go out there. I remember the first time I got on it, I was at Donington. Obviously, I know my way around Donington really well. I came in and I said, the thing's chattering really bad at the front. We need to look at this, we need to look at that. And the team said, well, we can't alter anything. We can't alter that. And they do chatter a bit. So I went out again. I got a little bit of understeer. I'm saying, well, it's understeering. We need to look at this. We need to try and change in the head angle. We can't alter the head angle. And every time I came in with a problem, they said, we can't fix that because of the rules. And I soon realised within about two sessions that you just had to get on and ride it. There was not a lot you could do within the rules. So what you did is you got on, you forgot the problems, you rode around them and you got on with it. And the fact of it is, if you were having a particular problem in a particular place, pretty much the whole field was having the same problem. And it was just a matter of who could sort of stick the neck out furthest, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sign of a real quality rider is somebody that can actually ride around the problems because that's just how it is. I mean, there's, like you say, there's not a whole lot you can do. And if you can adapt and change the way that you ride to the equipment that you're given and do well, then you're definitely a solid candidate.
Yeah. I love them as well because it looked from the outside, the championship, then the Super Sport Championship this year is a bit weak. 17 starters at Phillip Island last weekend, which is a weak field. But there was 36 starters every race when I did it. And I'm not saying the best lads were, you know, the fastest men were the fastest men, they still are. But the depth of field was a lot more. So if you missed a gear, five people came rattling past. Well, I love that. I love the idea that you could kind of, you know, it was some of the, you did a 25-lap race round, you know, whatever it was. It's a long race. But on a super sport bike, it used to go really fast because the whole race you was battling with some of the riders you'd heard of, some of which were young lads, some were old riders. You know, it was a good a mix of abilities and people trying too hard and crashing. It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
Now, you need to be careful with that weak field thing because I talk to Eugene Laverty all the time, and I have for a couple of years now. So if that gets back to him...
Don't get me wrong, it's not at the front, the fast men, you look at the times and they're still going quick. It's just that when I did Super Sport, the fast men were going, you know, in relation, no quicker, but there was, you know, I remember once qualifying 15th position on the grid, and I was half a second off pole. Well, you know, you're not going to get that with 17 on the grid, you know, you're going to get 3 seconds covering the whole 17 on the grid. So, you know, I'm not saying Eugene's a class act, and he's a clever, clever rider. But what I'm saying is it was bigger depth of field then.
Sure, and no doubt. Okay, so there's one thing, and I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. There is a whole bunch of videos of you on YouTube. I'm sure you know that, right?
Yeah.
But there is one that is absolutely outstanding, and I've watched it over and over, and especially when I was doing my my homework to try and have some information to talk with you. It is... Foggy, Carl Fogarty on a VFR 400.
Yeah.
And you on an RG 250, I believe.
RGV, yeah.
And it is just a hammer and tongs thing, and you did not come out on the top side at the end, but it is still an outstanding video. Is that one of a race that kind of sticks out in your head, that kind of thing?
Yeah, what happened was me and Foggy were both doing British Superbike at the time on 750cc Superbike. But our respective teams had decided in the wisdom that they'd put their sort of star riders into a new class, which covered 252 stroke or 400 four stroke road based machines. And it was the first time either me or Carl had ever sat on those bikes were that morning when we got on them. And to be honest, the fact was that they were so slow compared to our superbikes that it was always going to be a bit of a sort of laugh for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got going, and I thought that I could probably beat him on the littler bikes. Just the RGV, although it didn't come out of the corners so well, it had a lot more top end than Carl's 400. The two sort of just flipping flew top end. It was really good. Which you wouldn't expect, but it was a V4 400 he was on, a VFR,
right.
which tended to have the mid-range but not the top end. And we started the race, and it became a big race between me and him. And we were having a laugh with each other because on the straights, they were so slow that even a place like Alton Park, which has a lot of ups and downs and all, there's no real straight on the circuit, but on the faster bits, you had enough time to make a cup of tea behind the fairing. You know, it was that relaxed. And then I got waving at him, and I stuck my fingers up at him, and he's giving me the bird, and we're weaving about. But with about three, I was convinced, absolutely, with five laps to go, I would have put my whole house and my car on the fact that I would have beat him. I was convinced I was going to win, except for the fact, with about three to go, I got some kind of what turned out to be a partial seizure, and it stuck a ring, it jammed a ring, and I lost a bit of compression in one cylinder. You know what two strokes are like.
Absolutely.
And so what the advantage I had at the top end didn't, I'd lost it. And at that point, it became a kind of, almost a straight fight, really, but he had a little bit more lift out of corners. And my whole thing was, the 250 was lighter than his 400, and I knew I could outbreak him, but you could always stop the 250 quicker. But the fact was, I wasn't close enough at the end of any straight to get past him, so he beat me. And he annoyed me a little bit, really, because, you know, Carl's my best mate, but if you give him an opportunity to take the piss and get one over you, he will do. Do you know what I mean?
I absolutely do. I've read his books. I've watched tons of his racing over the year. And, yeah, you cannot leave a door open because he will slam it in your face. That's an interesting segue, because do you think racing is getting a little bit too homogenized these days? You know, we've got no 400 or 250 production class at the aisle. We've got Moto2 spec engines. What do you think?
To be honest, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what's going to happen. I mean, in British Championship now, we've had a really strong BSB for quite a long time in all classes, oversubscribed, lots and lots of people on the grid. But it is a fact that for a national championship, and I know you've been through a bit of turmoil in the USA, but with AMA Championship, but in BSB, people, there's less and less people can afford to run the superbikes. They're going to have to do something with them. And this year, they're trying this Evo class, which is essentially super bike chassis.
Yeah.
With a super stock engine, and we're going to see how that's going to go. At world level, who knows? I mean, for me, there is room for two championships, both a superbike and MotoGP. And at the minute, it's MotoGP that's struggling, and superbike looks really strong. But it goes in kind of, you know, it's sort of big cycles. And the fact is, if MotoGP start using what is road-based engines, you know, like 1,000cc street engines, in prototype chassis, it's going to be almost the same. And I think we've got to be really careful that, you know, you need a distinct kind of championship image and class. And MotoGP's kind of losing its way a bit, really. You know, they've got what is essentially a super sport bike now, is Moto2. They're not even going as quick as yet as what a super sport lap record is. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful, but something has to be done. And I really don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah, you know, the thing for me is I kind of just wish that Carmelo and company would spend a little time on the same rules for a while and let things solidify, because, you know, they keep coming up with this stuff and they always say that it's a cost-cutting measure, and in the end, you know, it's not. I mean, these companies...
Yeah, it works out that way.
Yeah, yeah, they're spending more and more trying to do all the R&D to figure out what the heck to do. And, you know, you mentioned Donington a bit back, and I just want to kind of get your thoughts on kind of what I think of as the Donington debacle.
Yeah, it's been a mess. And I mean, the big thing is that even when it was mentioned initially, they had a big finance guy, a big backer, pulled out. And from then on in, every single person who knew anything about it knew that it wasn't going to work. But yet they still went on and destroyed what circuit they had. You know, they dug the place up, and the whole place is like a huge building site that you cannot use. But everybody knew it was going to happen. Everybody you spoke to said, you know, it's not going to work. But yet they still went ahead with part of it and destroyed what we had. So, I mean, it's for me, it's really sad, because I live 70 miles away. It's my nearest circuit. And I spent a lot of time there from 16 years old onwards. It was all my racing was there in Cadwell Park, you know, and I loved the place. And there's talk of it becoming a DHL bonded area, you know, next to the airport, and never... racing not occurring there anymore, and there's all sorts of talk, but I mean, if there's no racing there ever again, I'll shed a tear, I've got to say.
Yeah, I think so too, and you know, for all its faults, you know, facilities and whatnot, watching races from there on the telly or through other means for me has always been kind of a special event. I've always thought it was very cool. You know, Silver...
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Donington's Donington, and you accept that. I mean, 25 years ago, it was the premier place. It had the best facilities, and nothing was done for years. But, I mean, so what? You've got a crap in a bucket, but, you know, the racing was always good, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way you put that. All right. So I think we've covered most of your racing career, and I want to talk about what you're doing now because, frankly, you provide for me, and this might surprise you. The work that you do with Jack and Tony is attractive enough for Americans because we don't get BSB over here in any way, shape, or form. And so what we have to do is find whatever method, usually something over the internet, to watch the races. And never mind the talent circuits. I mean, the chemistry that you and Jack have in particular is really good. Why do you think that works so well?
I don't know, because we are completely different people. The way it started was, he was doing the commentary with various people, including Neil McKenzie, when I was doing my last couple of years racing, and they were always at the circuits, came to talk to me. I knew Neil really well from previous years, been his teammate, and they normally got me after match, so the second Superbike race, I'd finished my Supersport race, got changed, and went and sat in with them for a bit of a, you know, rider's eye view, a third voice kind of thing, and then when Neil packed in with that, I took over, so it was almost by accident. And Jack is one of these people. He's a kind of older guy than me, and he's very, very sensible. And he's never ridden motorbikes, but
really?
He's never ridden them. But he, because of that, that adds something, because he looks at everybody who throws their leg over a racing bike and gets out on track as a hero, no matter where they finish. If you finish 55th and last, he still loves you because you're doing something that he would never have the balls to do. Do you understand?
Yeah, no, I do. It's amazing that he's never ridden.
No, he's never ridden a bike, and he looks, his background's photography of World Championship Motocross, and he all through the Brad Blackie days, the Harken Carlquist, all that kind of thing, and he loves all them guys, but he's also been to watch racing forever. He's been to the TT, he's been to watch transatlantic match races, he loves everything, and he's got this excited kind of Uber fan kind of feel to his, you know, he's always excited. He looks at me before we go on air, even when it's in the middle of the night and we're doing a recorded version and we're knackered and we just want to go to bed, he looks at me and says, oh, I can't wait for this. He's really, really excited about it. And he's kind of a boyish enthusiasm he's got.
Well, I mean, I think you both have that. Your perspective is just a little bit different because you've been there, done that, right?
Yeah. Well, I still look at it. I'll tell you what, I mean, My thing is now, I still know all the lads. You know, I go training with Leon Aslam. I've done a lot of cycling with him this winter. I know Cal Crutchlow. I know all them guys. And I think of myself, I'm a bit older than them, but I'm still a little bit of a mate of theirs. And I get nervous for them. You know, I remember how nervous. I mean, you're an ex-rider. You watch a grid full of riders about to do the business, and you cannot help that kind of nerves. You get nervous for them, and you know what they're going through. And I think that's what I have. You know, I don't pretend that I don't get nervous. I'm still a little bit scared and a little bit excited about racing, you know, even though I don't do it anymore much.
Yeah, to be honest, I was a little bit nervous calling you. It's the same way. It's the same way when I talk to anybody, because you're not sure how you're going to relate. But and that segues into something that I wanted to say, because this is absolutely key and it's totally clear. The grid interviews that you do, and they're fantastic. That's probably my favorite part of the Eurosport BSB stuff. And it's the reason that they're great is because it's really clear that the racers respect you, and that comes through in interviews. And that's got to help.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, the thing is, I mean, luckily, still they all know who I am and what I've done, which I'm not bragging, but I know what they're going through. And, you know, they kind of know I've crashed a bit and I've hurt myself a bit and I've won some races, and that's fine. But when I was asked to do the grid walks, you know what I hate? And I'm not mentioning names, but, you know, you get somebody who's never ridden and doesn't know a bike from a boil on the backside, you know, they start talking about what's your setup like, and they don't know what setup is. You ain't got a clue what rear suspension is, or flipping swing arm pivot position, or so you don't want to get into that. And as a rider on the grid, the last thing you want is somebody sticking a flipping microphone under your helmet, chin piece, and saying, you know, asking you to think about something that's really deep and important, and your brain is completely focused on the start, the first corner, and how well you're going to do, and what you're going to do, and what your plan is. So you can only stick to things that are, I like to get a little bit lighthearted with it, because, you know, as a rider, I used to love somebody taking the kind of pressure off me and stopping me thinking about what I was about to do, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really enjoy it. So I try to have a bit of a laugh, and I try to mention, I try to get across, if I see anything that's technically, I think, important, you know, tyre changes or whatever, I'll mention it, but I think, you know, people who've never sat on a racing bike, it's hard for them to discuss anything with it, you know, tyres or setup, or they don't understand it.
Yeah, there are a few that can do that. Susie Perry kind of got away for a while, but I think that's because she was, you know, kind of attractive.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, she wouldn't have got that job if she didn't look like me, would she?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny too, because I always laugh because what you do on the grid, you stay so late, and one of these days I'm just waiting for you to get run down when they throw the flag for the warm up lap.
Yeah, but what I tell you, what you don't understand is, I've got somebody, most difficult. Maybe you can do this. Maybe there's a technique and an ability to have somebody telling you where to go, what to do, and how long you've got left, and counting you out, and all while you're trying to talk to somebody, listen to what they're saying, come up with an answer to what they say, and it is really difficult to be directed at the same time as you're doing it. And that what I only stop there as long as they tell me to stop there, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm going to get run down.
And you made a good point about racers talking to racers, because I can actually see when you come up to somebody. And it's like they're almost looking forward to talking to you. I remember an interview that you did a couple of years ago, and I actually saved a clip of this, and I think I put it on YouTube myself. When Carl Harris crashed at Cadwell Park, I think those last few corners, crushed his finger, his pinky finger on his left hand. And you did this bit with him, and this one part that sticks in my head was you saying to him, "Are you mad?"
The thing is about Carl Harris. I mean, you've got to know Cal, and I know Cal really well. He's from Sheffield, which is just down the road from me. The man is he's a monster of a bloke. He's just a big, he's no Mensa candidate, but he's lovely. He knows what he can do, and he knows what he can't do. He doesn't try to do things he can't do. He doesn't try and do the Times crossword on Sunday morning. He gets on with racing his bike, but you have never met anybody as physically strong and tough naturally. You know, he doesn't. He's no, he doesn't go to gym working out that much. He does a bit of cycling, but he's a bull of a man. And you can't kill him. He just, anything that happens to him, he bounces back and just puts up with it. He got hit by a G6R 1000 that had just been crashed by Tom Sykes at Thruxton, and it bounced wrong, and it caught.
Oh, I remember.
Cal. It caught Cal smack in the face, right? Like 120 miles an hour. It scooped him off the bike, and I saw him later that day. He's bandaged up, his nose is broken, he's lost two teeth. It looks like he's done 10 rounds with a world championship heavyweight, right?
Yep.
And I says, "Are you all right?" And he says, "Yeah, can't remember what happened, but I'm all right." And he was all right. He didn't blame anybody. He didn't try and put a protest in. He just got about his business. And that, there's too few of them people left now.
Yeah, no, I remember that. There's like a really good picture of the thing just sweeping him off his bike, as you said.
That's it.
Yeah, amazing. Let me ask you a couple of questions, or at least one question about World Superbike, because I'm kind of interested in the way that you guys do your production. Do you do all of your announcing for World Superbike on site, or do you do some of it remotely?
The only ones we ever do remotely are ones where it's going to be a big baller getting a studio for the meetings. We've done, typically the ones we don't do on site, sometimes we don't go to Phillip Island, sometimes we don't come to the States. Otherwise, we go about 90% all the European rounds and some of the long hauls, but in actual fact, some of the real long haul ones, Australia, etc., it's kind of financially unviable just to do them on site.
Yeah, we've talked to, you know, Toby and Gavin and other folks here on the show, and it just kind of interests me amongst the various networks who kind of works whatever. More of a technical thing. This might be a little bit of a touchy question, so we can either leave this in or out, but I am curious. You've had some tough luck in your career, both with crashes and also with your personal health. Can you address that? I know it's going to be kind of a long bit, but
No. You're not going to upset me. I mean, the crashing thing is part of the job, and I've had some big crashes, but so what? I mean, most of the big crashes, to be fair, were at least partially my fault.
Okay.
So, you can't, you know, I can't, I can't blame anybody else for me crashing the bike. That's not bad luck. That's, you know, I was steering the thing, so, you know, I'm making the decision. So I don't blame anybody but myself for crashing. That's not, and I'm not bothered about any, sure, any of that. That's part of the career. But I was a little bit lucky with the cancer thing. Yeah, I was diagnosed in 1995, this summer, with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a form of cancer. And I got diagnosed. I've been weak for a while. I went to my doctor. They referred me to an oncologist, and had about 6 or 8 months of chemo. My hair fell out, and then I got better. And, you know, all I can say is I did what I was told, and I'm still here.
Good. And your health these days is great?
Yeah, it's all right. I go cycling a little bit with some of these young riders like Leon Haslam and Cal Cook. So, and obviously can't keep up, but I do all right and I'm happy. And, you know, the thing about having cancer and getting over it is mostly every day you think, yeah, we're still here. And you appreciate things differently to what you did before, you know.
Absolutely. It kind of brightens your outlook on life because you realize that you're almost lucky to still be around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest, I've lost. Now I'm into my 40s. I'm 43 now. And I've got friends in the who's actually died of cancer and other things in the 40s. And you think, you know what? It's a fragile thing. The crashing bit was, sometimes you can be so rogue. You can get off a bike at 150 miles an hour and smack into an air fence and go over a barrier. And you get up and walk away. But yet, the littlest thing can, you know, and you can be finished. It's a weird, it's the cancer thing, or certainly a near-death experience, gives you a little bit of a different slant on the whole life-death thing.
Yeah, I mean, you managed to make it through a broken pelvis, and I can't even imagine something like that. That in itself just, like, would freak me out.
Yeah, that wasn't too bad. But I tell you what, the whole worst thing of that was, I had a big external fixator thing with some screws going in and this big cage around my pelvis, which was a bit awkward, but it was all right. And I knew it was going to get better. They said, yeah, you're going to be all right. Your hips are all right. It's just your pelvis. But the worst thing was the blooming catheter tube. And it wouldn't come out. It pulled it. That two of them pulling it at the end. that was annoying.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, and I thank you for answering that. That's one of those questions you're a little bit afraid to ask, so I kind of walked into that tentatively. Something else is completely off topic, if you will. You run an airfield, Crows and Moor. It's a private airfield in West Yorkshire in the UK. Are you a pilot?
I am, yeah. I'm a keen, what would you call it? I'm a keen amateur private pilot. Yeah, I've got a normal British CAA PPL, and I've got a couple of little airplanes I fly about in, and I absolutely adore flying. I only actually got into flying in the late 90s because although my dad had always flown airplanes and I'd done a lot of flying as a kid sat in the right-hand seat, I've never, from being 16 or 15 onwards, I couldn't see anything other than bikes. I was so into me racing and my bikes that I didn't have any time for anything else. And going towards the end of the 90s, I met a friend who wanted to learn to fly, and I said, well, I'll learn with you. And we learned to fly and bought an aeroplane together and did some flying. And I'm with the flying now like I were with bikes when I was, say, 20. And I'm keen on my flying. I love my flying.
Sure. And if you could be a little bit more detailed, what are your planes?
I've got a share in a thing called it's a Jodel. It's a French airplane. It's got crank wings. It's called the DR250, which is a tail dragger, 4C, kind of 150 knot cruise, touring, take your family on holiday with airplane. And then I've got a thing called a Vans RV6. Kit built, American kit.
You got a pit?
No, it's an American kit. Oh, it's called a Vans RV6. It's a 170 horse, 2C, all metal, very fast kit plane.
Nice.
So that cruises at like 180 miles an hour, 190 miles an hour.
Do you use the planes to commute to the races?
Various. I mean, I haven't got an instrument rating, and you know, a lot of the circuits haven't got a facility to land. You know, they haven't got a runway. You can land on the. Sometimes they let you land on the main straight, but they're getting a little bit wary of that one. But I've managed to get to six of the BSB meetings in the aeroplane. I've I've done well at kind of finding little farmer strips that are near the air, near the race tracks, and so we do all right. Yeah, I've been to six this last year, but I really, I know I'm only a amateur kind of, you know, sure, nice weather pilot. Yeah.
Have you ever dragged Jack up in the plane?
No, Jack won't fly with me. I took, I did actually take Eurosport sent a cameraman with me from my own little airfield up to Knockhill in Scotland, and it's a beautiful flight. You go really over the backbone of Britain. You go over the Pennines and up through the Lake District to get to Scotland from where my place is, and it was a beautiful, beautiful sight. And they sent this cameraman with a handheld with me to a bit of a sort of a little bit of a. What you call a little bit of a fly on the wall kind of,
sure,
how I got there. You know what I mean? They put it out on Eurosport. And when we got there, they'd done the filming, and well, when it came to going home, he said, no, I don't want to come back with you. I'm going to get the train.
That's funny. That is funny. My mom was a pilot, and I went flying with her right after she got her license, and we flew down to the Solera Strip outside of Northern California. I'm from Northern California. Yeah. And she put the thing down hard, and she was cursing and all that. And I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, your mom.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a saying that any landing you can actually walk away from without a limp, you've done all right. It's a good landing.
Yeah, it's a good one. You know, you mentioned Knockhill, and I always thought that was kind of a little bit of a crazy track. But I do have a question for you about BSB circuits. Do you have a favorite? Yeah. I want to qualify that before you answer. I asked this of Leon last week, Leon Haslam, yes, and he gave me an answer, so I'm curious if yours lines up with him. Go ahead.
Well, I know Leon really well. I like the lad. He's a proper old school, because of his dad, obviously, racing years ago. He's old school, loves his bikes, and I reckon his favourite would be either Oulton Park or Cadwell Park.
Bingo on the second.
Right. So, he loves Cadwell Park, and I would say my favourite is, you always tend to like the ones you have the good results at. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's not necessarily the shape of the circuit. It's whether you got good results. I would say, for me, probably Oulton would get the number. But both Oulton and Cadwell are the two circuits in the country that are most like a traditional kind of roller coaster, country road kind of feel. You know, they're not a flat airfield circuit like Silverstone or Snetterton. The more up and down, kind of whizzing your way around through woods and that sort of thing, you know.
I think what I can take away from that is that you like something that is almost like a blend of real roads racing and a short circuit.
Yeah, I mean, for me, although I went to the Isle of Man about four or five times and decided not to go back, I actually love the idea of people, you know, racing around there. But to me, a beautiful circuit would be the Isle of Man, but with no houses to run into. You know, if the Isle of Man had the runoff, there would be nothing better. You know, but the fact is, it hasn't, and it is what it is, and people love going because it is the ultimate challenge of your sort of own nerve and skill. But for me, the circuits you can enjoy going around are the ones that have a bit of character. You know, not so much designed on a computer, you know.
Sure.
A lot of these circuits in Europe now, and the States is the same. The States is a good mix of oddball, kind of old school circuits. I've watched a lot of them on television, and there's bumps and there's off camber corners, and that's good because that's a test of your riding, and that's character. Whereas you go to somewhere like Valencia, right? You go there, that's been designed on a computer to fit the maximum number of corners into the minimum amount of real estate. You know, well, that's shit. I want to race around somewhere that kind of flicks me switch to ride around it, not just a little corner stuck into a flipping industrial park, you know?
Yeah, it's like the old Saxon Ring versus the new Saxon Ring. They're completely different.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you what, completely best one in Europe used to be, and it's gone now, they've actually changed it, was a place called Hockenheim in Germany.
Oh yeah.
And it, oh God, it used to go out of the infield, it used to, like a little stadium section.
Sure.
And then you went out into the countryside, and you were flat out for 2 miles, just flat against the stop. And there's nothing like that. You don't get that anywhere now. You're not allowed to do that now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we've become a society where people don't take personal responsibility, and everybody gets so worried about being liable for if something happens. Boy, we could wander off in a political conversation, couldn't we? All right, back on track. A couple of relatively generic ones, but it is something I'm curious about. What were your favorite bikes to race and why?
Again, it's like the circuit thing. You always like the bikes that you have the good results on. That's it. I mean, I have a real soft spot for a YZF 750 Yamaha. We had a factory, well, it wasn't a factory bike. I raced in Britain in 93, the first year of the YZF, and I won the British Championship on it. And I love that bike. But the fact is, it's crap compared to most bikes now. But because I had the good results on it, and it was good at the time, I really have a soft spot for it. Likewise, I have a real soft spot for the R6 Yamaha because I got some wins in World Supersport. And those are the ones, really. I liked which model of GSXR did I like? Probably the 98 bike was the best, but it was probably not capable of winning. Certainly with me on it, wasn't capable of winning at World Championship level, although we had
come on
the rostrums. But yeah, it wasn't. I don't think the bike was. It had a lot of top end, but the bike wasn't settled enough and developed enough to be a winner then. But it's still a good bike.
Do you still ride?
Yeah, I do a lot of riding. In fact, last week, I ride for an English track day company called Focused Events that I am one of their pool. I'm one of their pool of old, ex-decent kind of standard riders that he uses for sort of top-level instruction. So I do probably more laps around the circuit now than what I ever did. But obviously, you know, it's non-competitive and I'm training up guys who's paid for my kind of tuition, so it's good fun. I really enjoy it.
Sure, and I totally understand because I ran a racer school here in Northern California for a while, and it's actually a really satisfying work, isn't it?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I've been in Spain for 4 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, last week in a place called Almeria, which is more of a test track. It's a beautiful circuit. And it's got a little bit of everything, some blind crest, some off camber, some fast corners, some slow corners. And I got four guys with me on the Tuesday, and all I had all day to do was to train them four guys. And one of them, he started off really nervous, he'd had a crash last year, didn't want to get back on his bike really. And he came on, so he knocked about 15 seconds off his lap times. And to see his face, the guy's a 50-year-old guy, but he had a smile on his face like a Cheshire cat, you know. And that's, it is really satisfying.
Yeah, it totally. And it, frankly, I'm not doing it right now, and I really miss it. But did you get a chance last year at the end of at the final race at Portimao to test bikes?
Yeah, I did. I tested. Unfortunately, the one that I really wanted to have a go on, because I'd ridden an RSV4 Aprilia street bike, the actual standard version, I was really keen to have a go on Biaggi's bike. Because that is a little jewel. It's a proper. It's the nearest to a factory prototype that there is in World Superbike. It's just beautiful. It's a jewel. But unfortunately, an Italian journalist jumped off it the session before I was down to ride it, and they didn't have a spare bike, so I missed my session on that. Other than that, I rode Spies' Yamaha. I rode Jonathan Ray's Honda. I rode, Hager's Ducati. And I rode Corsa's BMW and was really impressed with, number one, how fast they are.
Sure.
But secondly, how they're totally reliant now on the bike doing a lot of the work for you. The full, compared to my day, where you did pretty much everything yourself, you blipped them on the back shifts, and you did all the kind of, you know, everything was done yourself by different techniques of you know, how late you change down the box, using your back brake, all that kind of thing. Now, everything is done for you. Most of them have automatic blippers, so you don't have to actually blip the throttle down the gears. They all have traction control. They all have kind of stepper motors to stop the rear wheel locking up into corners. Because I only got 5 or 6 laps on each, I didn't actually get enough time to get anything from it other than just have a ride around on it. You know, you need to be on these things quite a long time to understand how to work the systems, if you know what I mean.
Sure. You know, one thing that kind of bugged me, and maybe you can confirm this or not, is that it seemed like for the various different teams, some of them actually dumbed the bikes down for the journos, and some of them left them in full race trim. Did you find that?
Yeah. I think that every single one of them, from what I could figure out, had, you know, if your traction control system went from sort of 0 to 10, they were all on 10. I don't think they wanted anybody disappearing over the flipping handlebars, although people did. But I was No, I actually found that, certainly for me, I'd ridden for one of those teams before, and a lot of the mechanics in the paddock have been my old mechanics. So they knew that I could ride a little bit. You know, I'm obviously not up to speed at that level, but I think they gave me a reasonable bike. You know, certainly Arga's bike was vicious. I mean, proper vicious.
Yeah.
It wasn't the easiest bike to ride. Likewise, Speed's was just a flipping. I mean, it was so sharp as to be almost unrideable to the normal sort of man in the street. The best one of them all, or easiest, was Jonathan Ray's Tinkate Honda, because that's the most like a normal bike. You know, it was didn't have all the sort of trick bits on.
And I guess a secondary question to that is, Spies was pretty amazing last year, wasn't he?
Yeah, unbelievable. And not just, you know, how fast he was able to go on race day, but from the Friday, he was the fastest man on track at circuits he'd never even seen. He'd never gone around it in a hire car. And just his ability to learn the circuits, get the best from his bike, ride around a problem, you know, use a worn-out tyre better than anybody else. He was frighteningly good. He was. And I mean, every day, I've raced with Arga back in the day, and everybody really wanted Arga to win the championship, but not because they've got anything against Spies, but because Spies has got years left in, and Arga just didn't. You know, Arga, you just had that feeling last year that his only last big chance, really. But, you know, at the end of the day, when Spies had won it, you look back at the championship, and you have to admit, the best man won, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, if he hadn't ended up with some mechanical issues that put him out of some races, he probably would have, you know, led the thing toe-to-toe. And the comeback that he did, I think, you know, pats on the back to the Sterling Garda team. That was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you knew from the first round that Spies was just going to be, you know, difficult to be, almost like a kind of robot-like efficiency at everything. You know, there were no circuits he didn't like. The circuits that the bike didn't, you know, suit, mm-hmm. he just kind of got on with it. And ultimate respect for the bloke. And a good kid, you know, really. I interviewed him a couple of times. And he's just a nice, compliant kid that never slagged anybody off, and just a nice lad. You know, the thing about Arga is he has had his chance, and, you know, Arga's made mistakes. Spies crashed twice, lost the front end.
Yep.
Twice, I think. Maybe Aston and one more. But he had a couple of three breakdowns at where he's fallen. He ran out of fuel at Monza, the thing, electrical problem somewhere else. You know, he was the best rider, and that's it. And that's what a championship for me is all about. You've got to feel a little bit sorry for Agar, because I think now with the new kids on the block, you Haslam, you Jonathan Reyes, you Fabrizio, I don't think Agar's going to win it ever again. Well, he hasn't won it. I don't think he's ever going to win it.
Yeah, And I totally agree with you. And I desperately want Nori to get one before he retires. But right now it's kind of looking weird, especially after the great PI races that we just had. Trying to think if I have anything else. I don't think I do. Jamie, I could probably talk to you for about 4 or 5 hours if I could buy pints for you. I really want to thank you for coming on the show. This has been great. And if we get a chance to do it again during the season, I'd totally welcome that. And
I love you. You've got my number. Ring me anytime you want. Anything that happens that you want to know about that you're a bit out of touch with, feel free to give us a ring. And what I'll tell you what I've got to say. I've been to America a few times, and I've been to New York shopping with my missus for a weekend a couple of times and all that. And I've been racing in California. But last year, me and three mates had the best holiday, biking holiday. We flew into LA. We rented some bikes and we rode. We kind of went east into Arizona, up to Vegas, a couple of nights there, across the Rockies, down Yosemite, and over towards San Francisco. Then did the 101 back to LA, and we had the best holiday we've ever had in our lives. It was fantastic. And not only that, America's changed a little bit now. That everybody if the Yanks know you're a Brit, they actually like you now. Nobody else likes Brits. We got Europe. The French don't like us. The Germans don't like us. But Yanks actually quite like Brits still.
You know, everybody thinks we're so arrogant, but we're actually probably one of the most polite people on the planet, in a way.
We actually got people wanting... We we'd taken some big Union Jack, like about 8-inch square Union Jack. We stuck them on the back of the bike. And every single place we went, we got people coming up, oh, yeah, talking about anything. And we never got anything other than help. Some guy give us some advice because we went through Death Valley and he said, well, have you got, water? You need water. And everybody just wanted to help us. And we never get that anywhere. Brits, you just get frowned upon from all the Europeans. The Ayers, but the Yanks flipping, we had a really good time. It was fantastic.
God, seriously, this has been absolutely fantastic. And I, again, thank you for taking the time. If you ever get to the States, you're more than welcome here. And I hope you have a great season. And I really look forward to hearing your work this year.
Jim, thanks, man.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Huge thanks to James Witham for that interview. Probably one of the most entertaining and open interviews that I've ever done. You know, I keep thinking that they can't get better, but man, they seem to be getting better and better all the time. And
yeah,
a big thanks to him for being open, not only during that, but being open to us talking to him again, going down the road. So James, you rock. What do you think?
Yeah. I think what also comes across is he's an ex-racer, you know, world and national level. He was a BSB champion. You know, he's been there and done it, but he's so clearly also a fan,
mm-hmm.
you know, so he kind of bridges that gap between people like me who've never raced. You know, we do track days, we watch it, we ogle at these guys going, wow, you know, but he's been there and yet he can speak with the enthusiasm that I do, you know, it's something that feels completely out of reach. And I think that's absolutely amazing. He doesn't seem jaded or cynical about it. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And some of the analogies he used, some of the little stories he was, you know, just colouring the points he was making with, they're just fantastic. And some of the stuff is eye popping.
I know.
The foggy race when you mentioned the video, and hopefully we can get a link up on the show notes for that with him and Foggy. And they jumped on those bikes that morning, you know.
Astounding.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The thing that came across to me, and the thing that I actually see in certain racers when I talk to them, and you can actually hear it in their voice, and this is going to sound weird to some people, but what you can hear, and it's the same thing that came out in Jamie, is the inner child come out. The kid that is just having fun, you know.
Yeah.
This is play. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And when I talk to certain people, this, I know this sounds weird, but you can really feel it, and it's and I think the audience can hear that too. And those are the interviews that are really, really special. This was one of them. So, James, dude, thank you. That was great. And we look forward to talking to you again. And look forward to watching BSB World Superbike with you and Jack and Tony. And keep on doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. That totally made my day. So, wow, we've got a whole bunch of other stuff too, don't we?
We can look through the news. Now, this is getting a bit out of chronological sequence because obviously we've got PI to talk about and the second Sepang test. Yeah. But just running down, the Moto2 timings are just in from Valencia. First test with the new engines. And the amazing stat, I think, out of all of that is the top 20 were all within 1.5 seconds of each other.
That is kind of interesting because, well, you know, a lot of them are using relatively standardized chassis. We were kind of waiting to see if there was going to be anything, you know, like Akira-like coming out. But I think everybody was being real smart in using what is known and what works, right?
Yeah, that has been lamented by a couple of commentators I've read, saying that it's a shame no one has gone for anything radical. But what a risk in your first season.
Exactly. Well, I mean, right now it's all about sponsorship, and the only way that you're going to maintain sponsorship is if you have at least halfway decent results. But the results themselves have been kind of interesting in a way, if you will. I mean, some of the people that bubble to the top aren't ones that you would necessarily think so. Granted, Elias, everybody kind of had an idea. But today, and today being Wednesday, DeAngelis was up there, and that's not so surprising. Simone, et cetera, et cetera. Carry on, please.
Yeah, well, I think the surprising one for those of us who don't maybe as closely follow American racing is Kenny Noyes. Mm-hmm. Don't know a huge amount about him, know the name, but he was second quickest on the Jack and Jones Banderas Moto2. And as a Brit, I'm just sad to see that Simon's at the top. That's fine. And bookending the other end of the 20 riders in 1.5 seconds is Mike D'Amelio. And I like to think that Bradley, if he'd been given Mike's bike, might have got there a little bit closer to Simon. But we'll never know.
Very true. You know, and I guess another thing that was very strange about this test is that and it's a bit of a complaint, is that the 125s were very close and in some cases eclipsed some of the 250 riders. The Moto 2 riders.
Moto 2, yeah.
That's probably going to happen more than a few times this year. But I think that's okay. You know, they're saying that the engines are putting out about 125 horsepower. You and I talked about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it matters at this point. As long as the racing is good and you know that as the season progresses, that if things are looking a little wonky, they're going to make adjustments. They have to.
Sure.
The classes need to be incrementally better as you go up. I'm not worried. I'm really not worried.
What I found interesting as well is the IRTA spokesman making very aggressive comments about I expect the anticipated criticism at the fact they're only making 125, and he's saying, well, it just shows the fallacy of World Supersport being a so-called production-based series. And I thought, oh, that's fighting talk, that is.
Yeah.
But that was interesting to read.
It really was, and in fact, I'm like, that was a little bit over the top. You're right. I mean, those were fighting words, and I'm like...
Who rattled his cage?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He must have got a phone call that he wasn't too pleased with. Let's cruise back to the second Sepang test. Or wait. There's still a little bit.
Do you want to leave that to when we talk World Superbikes?
No, go ahead.
Well, yeah. All it was in the paper today. HRC apparently have promised 10 Carter factory components, staff and support in a big push for the World Superbike title. And Mr. Nakatomo has said that Johnny Ray will be welcome in MotoGP, which is food for thought. But it's interesting, because I know that 10 Carter have always had this somewhere between satellite and factory team status. The success they had, I think, Honda sort of wanted to bring them into the fold. And Ronald 10 Carter has obviously done a very good job of remaining independent whilst getting some fairly decent support, but this looks like they're making quite a big serious push. And it was interesting to hear what Jamie Whittam said, that Johnny Ray's bike, of all the bikes he rode at the end of season test at Portimao, was the one that was closest to a road bike in feel. Now to me, that's like, well, you'd think that means it's a bit softer and a bit gentler and it would be difficult to get it to the top, and yet certainly towards the end of last season, I mean, and we'll come on to talking about the PI shortly, but you know, his results might not have been quite what he'd hoped for, but certainly his rides were phenomenal. So that'll be interesting to see if that makes a difference.
You know, there really is something to be said for having a bike that is comfortable to ride at top pace.
Yeah,
because When you're pushing the limits and the bike is giving you essentially negative feedback, trying to figure out how far you can push it, especially if the feedback is weak, is the worst thing. You know, I actually had that conversation with Ron Haslam last week about the Hub Center steered Elf bike.
Yeah.
And he was saying it was numb and vague. Well, I kind of put that thought in his mind, but it was numb and vague. And if you don't know what the front tire is doing, if the 10 Kata Honda is actually providing solid feedback and literally ride like a street bike, only you can do that at race pace. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, because if you don't know, if you can't feel the front tire, you can't feel when it's getting close to the edge until you go over it. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. Why don't you walk through the second Sepang test results, because those were pretty straightforward.
Big shock, Rossi at the top again. Obviously, he said with a degree of sarcasm. Casey Stoner second.
I'll stop you for a moment. And he shattered, and I always love that term, he shattered the track record.
Yes, yes. But yeah, faster, significantly faster than the first test.
Indeed.
Lorenzo obviously was absent, recovering from his hand injury. Casey Stoner second, quarter of a second behind Rossi. Nicky Hayden, knocking 1.5 seconds off the previous test best result, comes in third. That is impressive. He really seems to be starting to feel at home on that bike. Or it sounds as if he's feeling at home on that bike. He looks a lot more positive and a lot happier with things. Colin promoting himself from his customary fifth to fourth. And Ben Spies, who seems to be trying to secure himself in the fifth place. And the two of them, it's interesting, there was an interesting take on this in this week's MCN, saying one of the big battles this year is going to be between Edwards and Spies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I mean, Colin is obviously helping Ben Spies a lot. So, surprisingly for a lot of people, I'd imagine, is Casey Stoner. Ben Spies and Casey Stoner are getting on really well. Apparently, they're both into bow hunting, which is different. But it kind of, I must admit, I have, you know, I know MotoGP OD has often been accused, wrongly in my opinion, of being a Stoner basher. I don't think that was ever the case. But I also think that Jules and Bob's comments about his public persona were very well appointed and were completely valid. But he's, I think a lot of people are starting to warm to him a bit.
Well, I mean,
yeah, the moral courage about taking the time out last year. And just little things like this that, he's not the sort of person you'd think who'd take someone from not only a different team, but a different manufacturer and sort of help show them the ropes. I think, oh, credit to the lad.
I think what he did, Martin, is I think he weathered the storm. To face that much adversity and to come back literally stronger than ever, if you think about it, is a very serious testament to what he is capable of. I mean, coming back at the end of last year and essentially kicking ass, how can you argue with that, right?
Well, they asked Rossi, Stoner, Pedrosa, how they felt Lorenzo's hand injury. They were all interviewed this week, how they felt his hand injury would affect the start of his season. Rossi and Pedrosa basically did the PR sort of, oh, I'm not going to say anything too controversial here, get a couple of digs in, but basically say, no, he's really good and he'll be fine. Casey Stoner just basically said, well, sometimes the less you have time you have to think about something, the better you go. Didn't hurt me much last year, did it?
Mm-hmm.
And left it at that. And I thought that was quite an interesting comment for him to make.
I'm always appreciative when racers downplay their own weaknesses, right? You know, look towards positive, and this is what we need to do. Don't place blame on anything but themselves. I think that's a quality that inherently proves that somebody is just taking care of business. Anyway, carry on, please.
In sixth place was Loris Caparossi with the new engine in the Suzuki, doing very nicely. And, I mean, again, I think we mentioned this after the last test. Suzuki's so often flatter to deceive. I think it's one of the best-looking bikes on the grid. I'm a Suzuki rider on my road bike. I have a degree of brand loyalty because they just make the nicest gearboxes. And yet they get into the season and seem to find a reverse gear. So I'm really hoping this time they might have put a decent package together. And I like Loris. He's a funny... Paul Denning said about him, didn't he? Nicest guy you could ever go out for a meal with. Stick him on a bike, he just wants to kill everybody. Andrea Dovizioso in seventh, improving and continuing to improve on the Repsol, and just behind him, Danny, and he seems to be having some issues with the Olin suspension. He's actually now publicly said that he's struggling to adapt to it after years of being used to Showa.
Well, think about what we have there. So in the Repsol garage, we've got the Olins, right? We've got new electronics. We've got Alberto, who's kind of been changed around in roles. We've got Livio Supo, who has clearly been changed around in roles, but may or may not be in. But you know that there is some information that's going back and forth, obviously, even though they don't think about it. So Repsol is, it's not a question mark this year, but I think at some point they're going to gel and they'll be a powerhouse.
Yeah, I also think this is a bit of a crossroads year for them.
Yeah.
And I can see both Repsol and HRC, and this is only, I mean, you know, I'm a very non-expert comment or observer of this, but I've got a feeling there might be big changes if they don't show a marked improvement. I'm not sure fourth in the championship for either of their riders is quite going to be good enough.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I think if Dovi were to do much better, fourth place in the championship for him and a strong showing might be good enough to keep him on the seat for next year. I mean, it's too early to talk about silly season yet, although people will start. Danny, but I also wonder if Danny will have had enough of them, and he might look for new pastures.
That is an interesting thought. I mean, or will either of those guys? Okay, yeah, we are silly seasoning. Well, I was about to say, well, either of those guys get punched, but I think it's a little bit too early in the year to. Okay, continue, please.
Tucked in behind them and a 0.2 back, which you're right, it's on a circuit that long particularly, it's a very small margin, but Hiroshi Ayama doing really well on this Interwetten Honda, which we're wondering if it's got some, well, we were talking about radical design in Moto2 and, you know, within what's allowed in MotoGP, we're just wondering if that's being used as a bit of a test bed. If it is, he's using it very well and he's having a good solid start pre-season, Ayama.
I think so too. So that brings us down to number 9. Number 10 is Alvaro Bautista on the second baby blue bike.
Suzuki.
And let's we'll just kind of, I'm going to run through really quick 11 through 16. We've got Depuñé, who managed to make it through without a whole bunch of crashes. Hector Barbera, Mika Kallio, Aleix Espargaró, and the rather unhappy Marco Simoncelli.
Yeah.
He's.
And that's probably worth a brief mention of. I mean, he cracked his helmet.
That was.
From yet another high side.
That was a nasty picture, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think that. I know we discussed this before about his crashes, and I was confidently saying, no, I think he's a tough character, and I can't see. He's looking a bit frazzled.
You know what he's looking like? He's looking like.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking like. You know, Marco Melandri was on the duck.
The Ducati, yeah.
Like swimming in mud.
Yeah, what's wrong? Why can't I make this thing work? Yeah.
And I'm not happy about that because I really thought he was going to come in and make an impact. You know, you remember the World Superbike races that he ran, and he was, you know, it was like amazingly and instantly solid.
Yeah.
So I hope he can figure it out. And you know what? It's not all up to him. A lot of it's up to Grassini. They need to step forward and provide him the people on the platform that will let him run its front because he can do it. No, he can.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that every cloud has a silver line, and the plus side is whilst he's near the back, he'll remain good friends with Rossi because as soon as he starts running at the front, he'll start having psychological warfare declared on him. But sorry, that's very cynical of me, and I'm going to get hate mail for that.
No, it's yeah, you will. All right, so you want to talk about? Well, there's a couple more things from that, so let's zip through those real quick.
Yeah, Masao Furuzawa stating early in the week about the move to 1,000 cc's in 2012, and has said, "Well, Yamaha are basically going to continue racing 800 cc bikes." And he talked about the massive costs in changing, research and development. They continue to come up with things to try and save money. But as you said to Jamie Whittam, leave it alone for a bit. You know, they've put all this R&D into making these 800 engines go so you only need 6 in a year for reliability. And now they say, no, we're going to go to thousands. And they said, no, we're going to stick with 800s. And then he put a little note on the end saying, depending on what our rivals do.
Yeah.
So obviously, if HRC and Ducati and Suzuki all go to thousands and start doing really well, I suspect Yamaha will have something in the pipeline. But I kind of understand what the point he's making.
Well,
it's like, hang on.
I mean, Martin, I think the crazy thing is there are all these forks in the road that everybody's going to take, and every one of those has a toll, right?
Yeah.
And every one of those is going to cost money. And if we're trying to reduce costs within the series, you cannot provide, you know, X number of options and expect money to be saved, because everybody is going to be exploring every option. And It just seems really crazy to me.
It absolutely. And I just think it's, I mean, every expert commentator and every fan I've heard give an opinion on it has said, you know, everybody knew that 800s wouldn't go slower than 1000s. They might initially, but as Rossi's made the point, and in fact the safety committee, all of them have made the point, the 1000s might have been slightly faster down the straights, but the dangerous speed is in corners. And the only way to make an 800 as fast, which they have now done, are there any of the lap records left from the 990s? I don't think there are.
I don't think there are.
The only way to make it go faster is to corner faster, which is where people get hurt. And it's so short-sighted. You wonder where, you know, who sits on the committees that makes these decisions, who actually knows what they're doing.
Well,
you know, it's like, oh, actually knows, understands the principles of a racing bike. And
the thing is that since the 800s have come out, there have been leaps and bounds made in tire technology. And so while the 800s may not have the raw horsepower of the 990s, the electronics and the capabilities of that combined with the absolute advances in tire technology are what have allowed the 800s to corner with significantly better speed than the 990s ever did, and, you know, giving up the weight difference, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you take that away, but I just don't like the weird dichotomy between the classes, and it's gonna be confusing for fans. People are gonna be like, what's he on? And it's, and again, I think it's going to be expensive for the manufacturers. I don't want to belabor it because, like we've said before, who knows what's going to happen when it actually gets laid in stone, and it isn't yet.
Sure.
It's not good.
Did you see sorry.
Yeah, well, it's just not good to have confusion at this point.
No. Did you see the Jerry Burgess interview he gave where he's getting more and more outspoken as he gets older.
Okay, so and I did, and I read that, and at the same time, what I thought was, okay, so Jerry's saying the thousands are a bad idea, right?
Mm.
Valet is saying the thousands are a great idea. It's like maybe the two of you should have a little chat.
I suppose to a degree there. I mean, it was interesting that he said that the way forward for a prototype series should be 600s. Because that's the burgeoning market. I mean, I'm not sure what he's basing that on, because certainly in the UK you get more people, because the biking public, or the bike buying public due to insurance and all that, are getting older and older. Generally, they have disposable income. They all want the latest R1 or the S1000RR. You know, they want the, they look for the 1000s, but the 600s are, certainly on the track, I think are a better, more usable bike, certainly for novices. So if you're looking at the bike buying public, 600s might not be a bad idea, but then again, that would be yet another change, and that's probably a discussion for another show.
Well, yeah, and I think that's when we build ourselves our own hit squad to go take a certain rulemaking person out. Alright, yeah. Hey, let's talk about some real racing. How about that?
World Superbikes and World Supersports.
And what a start to the season. Was that not impressive?
It was, and the only thing I found slightly worrying was the number of crashes. Now, I know Phillip Island has incredibly changeable conditions, and sometimes at the same instant on different parts of the track, but about a third of them went down at some stage of the weekend. Thankfully, not too many serious injuries, although there were a couple of exceptions to that. But the racing, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, tail to toe. And they're literally, and this is exactly, this weekend was exactly what you want. Maybe with the exception of World Supersport and one guy ran away with it, and kind of a friend of the show. But
we're not too unhappy about it.
Yeah, not at all. But in World Superbike, one of my favorite phrases, hammer and tong, and it was for both races, especially in race two. The top 10 for race one in World Superbike. Leon Haslam, kind of happy about that. We talked to him last week, didn't we? And he had a great view.
Fantastic.
Talk about timing, man.
Yeah.
That was way too cool. Michel Fabrizio, Nori Haga, in a valiant battle back because he had a really poor starting position. Johnny Ray,
yeah.
Max Biaggi, Sylvain Guintoli, who really figured in race two.
I like Sylvain Guintoli.
I do too.
He is a real character. He was interviewed on this show, wasn't he, at Laguna 3-4 years ago?
I think you're right. I forgot about that.
What a nice guy.
Yeah, very genuine. Very genuine.
Mm.
Carlos Checa, Jakob Smerts are perennial, well-scoring qualifying or free practice person. Troy Courser, you know, the BMWs aren't, like, they don't have it quite yet. Lorenzo Lanzi, and that takes us down to 10th. Down in the bottom, the guys that went out, Cal Crutchlow, third out, Christopher Mullen and James Toseland. And that's not a great way to start the season, is it?
No, and James Toseland, I mean, that was a nasty high side. He got flipped. I mean, Shaky Bernard had a nasty one in qualifying on Saturday. On Friday, and final qualifying on Friday. And he said, I got a bird's eye view of Phillip Island. I think JT pretty much did as well. And he'd already hurt his hand. One of the Eurosport commentators said he wouldn't show us it, but he did say he'd wrecked his left hand. Yeah, not a good start.
Yeah. And what was the name that didn't pop in there because he essentially ran out of motorcycles?
Yeah, Ruben Chaus or Zaus, depending on which pronunciation you subscribe to. I think two crashes on Friday, one crash on Saturday, and he'd only completed a total of something like 16 laps. Didn't make Super Pole because did he make Super Pole?
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't because he ran out of bikes. Rebuilt his bike for the race, and he was going to be obviously starting from outside the top 20. And in Sunday morning warm-up, he went into the back of Nori Haga at about 150 miles an hour. Nori got away with being battered, but was able to race, and obviously Ruben was taken away. And I think BMW didn't have any bikes or parts left by that stage.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. I mean, I think they went, you know, hat in hand to the team that runs Andrew Pitt and said, which is very odd if you think about it, which is a satellite team, and like, can we borrow some parts? And they were out too. Ruben's kind of had a reputation in the past for crashing, and I thought last year that he got over it in a lot of ways. I feel really bad for him, and I feel bad for the team, because if you don't get to race and all you're doing is packing up a collection of wadded up bikes, that's got to suck. I mean, that's just,
yeah,
that's the worst.
And how does he look his mechanics in the eye, you know, and they just must feel a bit. And I mean, 2 years ago when he was partnering Max Biaggi in the Sterrel Garda Ducati team, I thought he's really starting to show the sort of promise that people had seen in him 7-8 years before.
Right.
And he was starting to hit some good results. He won a couple of races. I think did he win at Miller?
Yeah.
He had some good runs, and he's a likable character. You know, he's larger than life. Last season, obviously, you know, like you say, it was first season of BMW. It was a learning curve. To start the season like this, you think, I don't know how much that's going to knock him.
Yeah, I mean, it really is hard to. If the worst thing that can happen to you if you're road racing is to get a dent in your self-confidence. Once that happens, it's really hard to bang out. And so I wish him the best, and I hope the team continues to back him. He's not like a Robbie Rolfo. You know, he's got the spirit and the I'm going to get in trouble for that, too.
No, I remember watching him at Donington wipe out Leon Haslam.
Yeah.
When Leon was on a wild card, and I was furious with him, and I just thought,
you know,
it's you again.
You know, it was funny, and I think I mentioned this last week, was Josh Brooks, Sylvain Guintoli comment, and as I was watching this weekend's races, I'm like, well, Sylvain's just like staying as far away from Josh as he can, and
Yeah.
seems that all worked out. Okay, but... That was very cool. And then in between that and race two, we had, and like you say, and I have no problems with the results of this, we had a super sport race. Well, we had two super sport races, didn't we?
Yeah, and that was a real shame. First race started, and it was, if I remember, six laps in.
I think so.
And Chaz Davis was doing, I think he was fourth at the time, wasn't he, on the Triumph, doing really well. I was rooting for him. You know, he's a local lad from this area. He's come home, even right to Australia. But, you know, he's back on the world stage where Brits can cheer for him. And then his Triumph blew a rocker cover, was it? Or it was oil peeing out of it anyway. I still wasn't sure if he'd gone down or not. Someone went down behind him, races red flagged. And we pretty much didn't see him in the restart, did we?
Yeah, we actually lost both 10 cutout riders. You lost Safua and Piro. You remember when you and I talked not so long back, I actually threw in my predictions, I was like, Safua or Piro, one of those two were going to be third. And as it turned out, one of them was. But let me run through the okay. Actually, let me finish up your thought there. So they red flagged the race, and there was a kind of a discussion for a bit about whether or not it was going to be an aggregate or a restart. And I was hoping for an aggregate because Eugene had, I guess the only word you can put on is a commanding lead. And yeah. Like I said, Eugene is a great friend of the show. And we'll be on again soon, so you folks stay tuned. Johannes Scores doing a great job. And so here's your top 10. Eugene Laverty, Johannes Scores, Safu Aglu, David Salom. Which is impressive. I actually find that very impressive. He was a top amp.
Yeah.
Not, you know, 7 seconds off the box, but still a very solid performance. Fabien Ferret on Akawi, back on Akawi after a bunch of years. Massimo Rockley, Robin Harms, one of those guys again.
Mm-hmm.
Jason DeSalvo in his first World Supersport race.
That's a good result.
Yeah. Clapping hands. Miguel Praia, very solid result for the Park Algar team. And in 10th, Gino Ray, who is a former Superstock champion, and picked it up. I'm not sure why Fujiwara was all the way back. Chaz Davies in 12th, and he had an electronic problem. And then on down the rest of the field, Piro and Lund. But it was a fun race to watch. But, you know, basically Eugene just mastered it, much like he did Kyalami last year. But he said it was even easier.
Yeah.
He basically said it was an easy race for him, which doesn't bode well for the rest of the guys. If it's that easy,
And the key stat there is Eugene wins and Lascaux is 4.359 seconds behind. Okay, I mean, it's less than 4.5 seconds, but it looked a lot more.
Well, yeah, and every time that they would start inching up on him, he would just sprint off again. You know, he easily capable of maintaining that lead. And
did Leon Haslam's comment about not sandbagging but not showing all your cards too early to everyone else cross your mind when you saw? Because in the qualifying and the testing, Eugene had been up in the top pack, but he wasn't head and shoulders above, and I just wondered how much, you know, was he just holding a little bit back, and then it's like, now I'm going to show you what I can really do.
I'm going to have to wait to talk to him, but knowing his mindset, and I have talked to his former crew chief, who now works on Miguel Praia's bike, I would say there is a slight bit of subterfuge going on.
Yeah. He strikes me as he's a canny racer, I think, Eugene. You know, he's not just a head down, you know, take your brain out, leave it behind and go for it, as people have said about Ben Spies. You know, he's a thinker. And, yeah, it was very impressive.
Yeah, that team has a very, very intellectual approach to racing. And they're actually very good at setting aside the emotional part of it and... I'm always impressed. You know, maybe it's because I'm more inside, if you will, for it. Anyway, moving on. Yeah, so Supersport kicked ass, and I was very happy to see Eugene win. Why don't you walk me through Superbike Race 2?
Race two was another of those. This is what the edge of your sofa was made for. And because I spent all the time on it, I watched it with Sharon and we were rooting for Leon again. But early doors, Sylvain Guintoli got himself up front and was looking. Well, it was that leading pack of four. There was Guintoli, Leon, Michel Fabrizio, and initially Norrie. In fact, initially Johnny Ray, who then ran off track and ended up 20th. And when we go through the results, anyone who hasn't seen it and has missed the fact that these are spoilers will find out how well he did. Norrie just started to drop back, and obviously he was having painkilling injections in a swollen arm before each race, so that's quite understandable. And then Carlos Checa worked his way through the following pack, closed the gap. There was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, wasn't it? Fabrizio led for a little while, I think. Leon was back in front. And then Carlos Checa came up, and I thought Leon was going to break. I thought he was going to break away and create a bit of a gap. Reading the post-race reports, his tyres started to go off, and that wily old fox. I like Carlos Checa, but it's like, oh, come on. Leon's just won his first ever World Super. Just let him have a double. Be nice. No, it's not what it's about. He's racing, obviously. But fantastic performance from Carlos Checa. And I've just read a couple of bits he said. He thought, I don't want to do anything silly. And I was thinking back to when he wiped it. Wiped out Max Neukirchner, didn't he, 2 years ago? When Max was about to win his first race, and he said, I thought, if I'm comfortable and I get the opportunity, I'll take him. If not, well done, Leon, I'll take a second. And they came, it was off Lukey Heights, wasn't it? I think they came down, and Leon had that wide line. He uses quite different lines from the others, I found, in a similar way to the way Troy Bayliss used to. But it seemed to be working for him. He left the door open. Carlos went through, and there was nothing he could do about it. And there we went. Carlos Checa won race two. Shall we run through the finishing order in that one?
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about, let's run down the top 10 at least, and then talk about sort of the outstanding things. Go for it.
Sure. Carlos Checa from Leon Haslam. Michel Fabrizio, another good solid finish, third place. He was 0.004 at 4,000 a second in race one behind Leon, which I'm told is a World Superbike record narrow finish. Sylvain Guintoli, another really strong performance. So chuffed to see him. By the way, I don't know if you, if people didn't see the Eurosport commentary with James Whitten, but James is pointing out we've adopted him as an Englishman. He lives in Leicestershire and he's married to a girl from England and he swears in English quite fluently. So. And isn't aware he's doing it. He's not sure what a swear word's or not. Well, that's what he claims, anyway. Norrie in a fifth, which that's a couple of good results considering his injuries. Johnny Ray, sixth, having dropped to 20th. And that was impressive. It was very impressive to see. Unfortunately, we didn't see enough of it because there was so much going on up the front.
Sure.
But every time they ran the positions, you're like, oh, Johnny's gone up a couple more. Troy Corsa, seventh. Not their best result ever. But a good solid chain from the BMW, at least in Corsa's hands. Max Biaggi, eighth, and not doing as well, I think, as expected. I think everyone expected that RSV4 to come out of the blocks pretty much banging, as they did the R1s.
Yeah, and last year, I essentially threw a wager down that with somebody from online that the RSV4 would be on the box very quickly, and they were, you know, race two last year, and there were a lot of people that were doubting, and I don't know what it is this year. You know, circumstances, just things didn't come together, budget, whatever. But
a quick aside on the Aprilia is this: Neil Spaulding's comment column in MCN talks about the fact they may be in a bit of trouble because they swapped their chain-driven camshafts for gear. Driven camshafts.
That's a good point. And plus, they had their relatively large recall. There were a fair amount of the RSV4s that they had to bring back in and literally replace the engine. So that might have taken away some of the money for the team. Who knows?
It's just interesting because there was an interview with Ronald Tencarter on Supercast, I think, and he was talking about, you know, World Superbikes, there's quite a lot of leeway. And he said, you know, you could either go down the production road or like Aprilia, virtually make a prototype and we'll find out if it is or not. And it was almost a little snipe of going, that's almost a MotoGP bike. And with this, I mean, Neil Spaulding's point is, if you can't go to your Aprilia dealer and buy a gear-driven camshaft modification for your RSV4 on the road, it's not homologated. And I know there's a time frame within which they're allowed to do it, but that'll be interesting to see if the other teams start to say, Having said that, whilst they're finishing 8th and 11th, I don't think anyone's going to be that bothered.
Yeah, I mean, I have said since day one, and a lot of people have kind of like looked at me askew, that really the RSV4 is basically a MotoGP bike with mirrors. But the difference being is they made a whole bunch of them, you know, so it's not like, you know, the Desmo Sedici road bike, which if anybody was willing to enter it into a national or international road race would probably make a pretty good bike, even though it's like detuned to the gills. Anyway, carry on, please, sir.
Sure. 9th and 10th, Cal Crutchlow and James Toseland. I mean, James Toseland's obviously quite banged up. So that's a pretty, you know, he's finished top 10. But with neither of them, I think that's what people were expecting. And I've got to admit, I hate to say it, I take no pleasure in it at all, but I have to disagree with Guy from last week. I haven't been expecting JT to come out the blocks. I think he could do with a steady year and just rebuilding a bit of confidence. I wouldn't be surprised to see him running near the front later in the year, but at the moment, he must be feeling a bit like Marco when he went from the Ducati to the Hayate. And yeah, he did better than expected, but as the season went on, they had no development and he's going backwards. It must seem a bit like, hang on, when do I get the good bits again? You know?
True.
And I would like to mention 11th place in both races, both of them Leon Camier. Both times he'd been running up in the top five or six, and at the same corner, well, he said on the second race he managed to hook a half gear, and he ran off, managed to get back on, but I did like the look of him. I thought he looked very comfortable, he looked very smooth. He's an interesting character. He's far too tall to race bikes. He's something like 6'2".
Hey,
you know, he's.
I'm 6'2".
You know what? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I am.
I'm thinking about the photos. Actually, you are. Yeah, you are taller than the other guys. But it's like Bradley Smith keeps growing, and everyone's wishing he'd stop.
Yeah, the jolly red giant.
But it's got to make it harder. And that Aprilia is not a big bike, is it?
So I think this is a fallacy that a lot of people are thinking about. I sat on one at Miller during the World Superbike races last year. And for me, at 6'2", it was very, very comfortable. And this is
really?
Sitting on a multitude of race bikes in the past. It's just different. You know, it's all about geometry, Martin. It's like
The
point to point to point. So ass to hands to feet, and as long as that all works out, and you know, a lot of it depends upon what length of your legs are, length of your arms are, etc. in torso. For me, it felt fine. Now that being said, I've been scrunching myself into tiny little, you know, small displacement road bikes or road and race bikes for years. But I thought it was okay. But you know, you're right.
I suppose I'm basing that on the fact that Max Biaggi looks in scale on that bike, whereas on the Ducati, he looked like he'd nicked his dad's bike and was shooting down the shops on it.
Yeah, he's like a 5/8 miniature.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, I was impressed with Leon Camier. And I like the fact that his team have said to him, we're not expecting miracles.
Right.
Learn the tracks, learn the bike. You're on a 2-year contract. Chill out. Calm down. You know, and you know, do what you can within your limits. If he can learn to, you know, prevent the red mist descending, I think Leon could have some good results. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him finishing in front of his teammate every now and again.
I agree. You know, there's one person from this last race weekend that I actually felt really bad for, and that's Shane Byrne.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coming into the weekend and coming after the test, he had great results. He had a great Friday and then had a big old high side and just pretty much slammed onto his back. And prior to that, it was clear that he would have an excellent, excellent finish to the weekend. And in the end, he didn't. It's important to that team. They're pouring a lot. I've looked at the pictures of their garage. They're pouring a lot of effort and heart and money into it. And yeah. I was really bummed out for him.
Yeah, and he said, you know, the difference in resources between Altea and Sterilgada as it started last year, you know, is very noticeable. And it's such a shame because, you know, basically that bike is the basis of it is the BSB bike from 2 years ago that he won the British Championship on at a canter. And, you know, he fits the bike. It suits him. He's such a good rider. He's another one who, you know, he can have a bad start. Like Norrie last year when he won from 13th on the grid this year, you know, he's had two solid results there from 10th. Shaky can carve through traffic, but it was such a shame to see that or to hear that that had happened. In that sense, I'm glad they've got a month off. Yep. They can all shake the bruises out. Lorenzo Lanzi in behind him, 13th. Not much to say about that, I don't think. And Josh Brooks. One thing I think worth mentioning, Max Neukirchner.
I know.
What's happened to Max? I expected to see him come back good and hard, and oh dear.
I'm still wondering if there are lingering things from the Monza crash, that horrible Monza crash that he had last year when he was taken out. Plus the secondary crash that he had when he tried to return in a test day.
And he broke his back, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he horribly broke his leg in the Monza crash. Multiple fractures. And he kept the spirit through that whole thing, and I was really pumped for him. But then to get knocked down again immediately and break your back. And I love Max. I actually think he's a really cool guy and a really cool rider and somebody that kind of, you know, keeps your head up even when faced with some serious adversity. Man, I hope he can get it back. I still think he's got it. But again, like we've talked about earlier, if your confidence gets wrecked, that's the hardest thing to fight through.
Yeah. Yeah. And it must be difficult to try. And it's almost like you need a bit of luck to break the negative cycle and get back into a positive one. Indeed. And confidence breeds confidence just as, fear can breed fear. Well, not fear, that's probably the wrong word, but doubt.
Exactly. Doubt can breed fear. And so there's another person that's down near the bottom of the list that I'm, being an American, I'm kind of bummed about it.
I thought this was probably worthy of mention too, yeah.
Roger Hayden, little brother of Nikki and Tommy. Tough weekend. Now, granted, the ZX10R is probably not the best platform. Apparently, next year they're supposed to be having a massively resolved or revised model come out. And I sincerely hope they do because, you know, Vermeulen and the rest of the crew, everybody's been struggling on that. You know, it's a great bike if it's a 600.
Yeah.
If it's a liter bike, not so good. So, best of luck on that. Roger, keep your chin up, man. You're there. Stick in it for the duration. Make your contacts. Do the rounds. Learn the way of the series, and I think you'll be good.
Yeah. It was an interesting comment made by Jack Burnicle, I think it was, that one of the big selling points of Chris Vermeulen to go to that team was he's always wanted to be more involved in the development of a bike, and that was part of the promise, was that he would be very influential and instrumental in the development of the 2011 Kawasaki. So, fingers crossed.
Indeed. I just don't like to see people struggle, especially when it's, you know, their sophomore year into a series. It's like, give them at least something that will give them a carrot to chase. And when you don't have that, you can feel the frustration for the rider. That's just how I feel. What else from the World Superbike weekend? Anything else you want to touch on?
It was just the thing of Fabrizio, which quite a few people have mentioned. Jamie Whittam mentioned it. Has Norihaga's time gone? I mean, we absolutely love him. He's fantastic to watch. He's such a nice guy. But you just think, this weekend, you know, he was injured, and it's too much to... it's not enough to base... Going back to the serious point, Fabrizio was a bit of a random number generator last year, wasn't he? He could be at the front, or he could wipe several people out, which he did. And Ben Spies is probably happy he's not followed into MotoGP. Or he could just sometimes not turn up. You know, he'd go to some races and you think, you'd be watching it and you think, oh, this is really good. You think, and where's Fabrizio? Has he crashed? And no, he's in ninth. And if he can get some more consistency, I just worry for Norrie that maybe his time's passed and there's too many people who can challenge him or who can take points away.
It really is a different field than it has been in the past, and or at least I think so. And I think what's happening is, it's very cool in a way, but there is becoming this level of parity that I don't think we've seen in a long time. And I don't think it's because it's a depleted field, if you will. Well, I think all of us are like still shell shocked by the hurricane called Ben Spies that came, or the Texas a Texas tornado, if you will, that came through last year called Ben Spies. But and Colin's going to be like, hey, that's my turn. But it's very, you know, I can look across a whole bunch of people in the paddock right now in the World Superbike Championship, and I can say, okay, there's a whole bunch of guys who can challenge for the front every weekend, and you don't really know. And this is what I love. You don't really know who is going to win for the weekend. And I think that's the exact way that it has to be.
Yeah. And that's that. I'm trying to think, when was it it was last season. I think at one stage there was a point made on the podcast that race by race, World Superbikes, to watch a race in isolation, World Superbikes was really exciting and close. But as far as the championship went, at one stage, Norrie was completely running away with it, and then Ben obviously caught him up. MotoGP, though, when they went to Catalonia, and there are three riders all on 107 points, the championship was closer in MotoGP. And I do think for the season-length interest, if we can have multiple winners, it just makes it... You don't know what to expect any weekend.
Indeed. I think if I remember back for last year for MotoGP, at one point, and my memory is probably failing me here, but I think we had a 3 or 4 way tie, and I think it might have been around Catalunya time, which was amazing. You know, we're well into the season, and here we've got a bunch of guys tied up. Now, granted, right after that, a whole bunch of weird things happened, and things spread out, but if you're that far into the season and you've got no idea what's going to happen, that makes for some incredibly exciting racing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as you go through the season, I don't know, but I would imagine the racers have got to be looking to each other thinking, well, if he's in front of me on the last corner, he's, 50 points behind me in a championship, that's not a great disaster. Whereas if someone else is in front of me, I'm going to go for that last corner lunge because strategically I need to be in front of him. You know, and so the season progression starts to have an effect on how people run their races on an individual race basis. And that just brings a whole, as you say, a whole added dimension to it. And fingers crossed that no one's going to run away with it.
True. I'll take whatever I get, frankly. But I will. But it is always nice to have. The thing that I always hate in MotoGP is if we get to Valencia and nothing matters. That is the thing that just kills me. And it pretty much has almost ruined the reputation of that race, because that's what happens quite often. It's like, race zero at the end. But Yeah, I don't want to bag on Valencia. Valencia is still a neat race, but okay. What else? We've got a couple of things from there. I think that pretty much covers Phillip Island, doesn't it?
I reckon it does.
Okay. Then a couple of small things. You sent me something that was really cool about Jeremy McWilliams.
Oh, this is... I just think this is fantastic. And I think you're right. This was mooted to run last year. And basically, BSB... Every BSB race has a number of support races running. And at some of them this year, and I think they're still to confirm exactly which, but I'm sure Silverstone is a nailed-on one, Harley-Davidson are going to be running a single-type XR1200 support race at some of the BSB rounds. Jerry McWilliams is going to race in them. He's 46 in April.
Really? Wow, that's almost as old as I am.
That is fantastic. Yeah, he's old enough to be my
uncle
brother. Yeah. I used to love watching Jeremy McWilliams race. He was one of those complete, you know, if I'm going to turn up, you're getting everything I've got. You know, he's a real character, and he's racing for, I haven't actually got my notes here, I can't remember the name of the company, but they were established in 1924 in Kings Road, London, the Harley-Davidson dealer. They're back in his team, and that's going to be a cool race to watch.
So let me just jump in here for a moment. I remember when they thought about doing this for last year, and I'm assuming that, you know, the economy and had to back this thing up, but there were two other names that I'd heard mentioned.
Yep.
One of which we talked to today, which was Jamie Witham. And I thought that was really cool. But the secondary one, which I thought was even cooler, and I kind of heard whispers of a few other ones, which was Niall McKenzie. And a lot of people think these are, you know, big lumbering bikes, but they had a championship they were running, I think in Italy or France or somewhere like that, as you say, a secondary support race. These things were railing.
Yeah.
Granted, it's a heavily lumbering monster, but they were still railing on them.
It's struggling to find a niche in the market, the XR1200 here, I think, because people aren't quite sure what it is. We don't have a background in Britain of flat track racing. You know, that it's not something that happens. You know, people either go to motocross or enduros, or they go to road racing, you know, circuit racing, or obviously the TT and the Northwest 200 and like the long road races. So people aren't quite sure what it is. It's like, well, it's a Harley, but they say it's got a race background, but it doesn't have fairings. You know, it doesn't look like our idea of a race bike. So I think this could be quite good for Harley. I just think it will be a fun race to watch.
It will be. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those situations, as opposed to road use, where loud is good. And it should, if nothing else, be entertaining, and particularly because it's really hard to wrangle a bike that was never designed as a race bike, because, you know, all the super sport bikes are basically, you know, race bikes with mirrors. That is not a race bike with mirrors. That is a cruiser with mirrors that has been somehow magically turned into a race bike.
Yeah, I just think it'll be fun.
I do too.
And I'm if they're running it at Alton Park, I am definitely going to that race, because the Alton Park BSB is something to behold. It's not the easiest circuit to get a really good spot because it's so hilly, so you can only ever see some of the track. But that would be interesting to see Harley's doing that. Yeah.
Cool. Very cool. All right, so not a whole bunch left. You know what, we'll try and put links into the show, and I always forget to get a lot of these in, but I promise I'll try and be a lot more accurate this time, because I know that I've kind of missed some and people are bugging me about it. I do want to say, Mary Costello, who we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, I understand you're in the hospital and you're ill, and I just want everybody to sort of send good thoughts her way, because that's not good. And Martin, it's been fantastic to have you back on again. Dude, I'm pretty sure at this point you're full time.
It's been an absolute buzz. And, you know, to be able to talk on the same show that James Whittam, and I've got to stop calling him Jamie, because I think it's one of those. Well, I was just looking at the book title again, and his author title is James Whittam. It's W-H-I-T-H-A-M. Cannot recommend that book enough. It is, I'd say it's probably the best road racing or circuit racing account book I've read. It's absolutely hilarious and very, just as his interview was, really revealing. Back you up on the messages of Goodwill to Maria Costello. And also, on all the things we talked about, one of the things I'm really getting into here is the listener email. Even the stuff that, we can't sort of read out or discuss everything we get, but it really moves the discussion along, and it's fantastic to get.
Yeah, and so what Martin points out is up until this last week, he hadn't been on the regular list for listener email, and now he is, and he's probably getting bombarded. I imagine that you are, and you're probably like, whoa.
Oh, it's brilliant. Some of it's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, but
and the diversity of subjects that people get passionate about or just want to make a comment about is—it's
amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. So keep it coming, and even people giving feedback or sending stuff that's critical—they're so polite about it. I'm like, no, come on.
Trust me. At a certain point, you're going to get one that that will actually make you wince. Just you wait. All right. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, audience. This is going to be, it's clear this is going to be a really long show, but I think between the chat that Martin and I had and the really cool interview that, thank you very much, James Witham, gave us, I think this is going to be a great week's show. So, Martin, I will talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jim. Good night, all.
Cheers.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGP OD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.